Attention all passengers. The Uber ride for Mark and Jamal's romantic weekend will depart in 4 minutes from Platform 6. Your ride comes with a rolling countryside sunset view and a table seat ideal for playing footsie beneath. Thank you for booking your tickets on Uber.
Trains on Uber.
Welcome to Immigrantly. I'm your host, Fadia Khan. Politics is an elusive concept, and many of us try to give it structure by ascribing to different labels: progressives, conservatives, moderates, leftists, socialists. Yet politics is also fluid and ever-changing. How we interact with it, how we engage in it. In this moment, I identify as leftist, not necessarily progressive. In recent times, people who call themselves progressive are selective in their progressivism. They, including progressive women, are progressive when it suits them and downright genocidal when it doesn't. But today I'm sitting down with someone whom I respect for honesty and who's fighting for what progressivism really means to him. Chuck Park is running for Congress in New York's 6th Congressional District, Queens. He was born in Flushing to Korean immigrant parents who sold T-shirts on Canal Street 10 to 12 hours a day before they could afford to open a small business. He grew up to become a U.S. diplomat, served in different places, including Vancouver. Then in August 2019, after a white supremacist walked into a Walmart in El Paso and opened fire, killing what would ultimately be 23 people, Chuck Park, whose own son was born in El Paso, had already made his decision. He sat down and wrote his resignation letter. He published it in the Washington Post and walked away. Now he's back in Queens, going door to door, making dumplings with strangers and running a 100% grassroots campaign against a 7-term incumbent. No corporate PACs, no APAC money, no foreign lobbying dollars. He wants to abolish ICE. He wants Medicare for all. He wants to end military aid to Israel. And he calls what's happening in Gaza a genocide. Out loud, on record, without a press team telling him to soften it. This is the kind of politician I didn't think existed anymore. So without further ado, let's jump right in. Welcome to Immigrantly, Chuck. So good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Sadie. It's my pleasure.
So we were talking about food. I know you do dumplings and dialogue with people, and then you talk about immigration policy, which is wonderful. But before we started rolling, I was telling you how much I hate cooking. What's your relationship with cooking?
I like to cook and I'm really bad at it. So my go-to, and it wasn't just my go-to, it's probably my parents' go-to after a long day of work. My parents are Korean. They came to Queens, New York City in the 80s, but they were busy working all the time. You know, our grandma helped raise us. I think that happens in a lot of immigrant homes. But our go-to for a lazy dinner was 2 packs of instant Korean ramen, throw some eggs in there, and then throw in whatever vegetables you happen to have in the fridge. So that was our go-to growing up, and it's my go-to today.
I think that's a whole meal. I think it has protein, it has carbs.
It's got protein, it's got carbs, it's got MSG. You definitely need that.
And something wrong with MSG,
no,
though.
That MSG thing is a myth.
It is a myth, absolutely.
It was built, I think it was called like Chinese food syndrome, but it was written by like some white food writer in the 70s or something, just talking about how he gets sleepy after eating Chinese food. He blamed it on MSG. Turns out it's total BS. MSG is fine. It's just a flavor, you know, enhancer. It's like salt. But it created this myth that MSG is terrible for you when really it's miraculous. It's delicious.
So when you do dumplings and dialogue, what are you trying to achieve through that?
So one, I'm trying to achieve a full stomach. And, you know, I think I personally love dumplings in all their forms. Now, obviously, I love Korean mandu. I love momos from Tibet or Nepal. I love soup dumplings from China. But I, you know, ravioli, pierogi. I think there's this universality in dumplings, which are just carbs and wrapped around protein usually. And so, yeah, it's about eating, but it's also about that communal food making that opens the door to communal everything else. I was trying to reconstruct this experience that I think a lot of immigrant kids have had. And again, this spans all nationalities, ethnicities, but of being in either a church basement or a masjid community center or your living room where it's your mom and your aunties and a grandma and everyone's just gathered there communally making dumplings. And it's in those settings that people are catching up on gossip. They're sharing tips about school. They're talking about how to get a loan for a small business, all while the kids are running around. And so I wanted to create that, but not have the family element there, just trying to create the food and have food be this convening thing to start those conversations.
Any memories from those conversations, something that really stands out to you?
What's interesting is we did our first Dumplings and Dialogue in Forest Hills. And Forest Hills is also a diverse neighborhood. It's along the subway line, the EFMR. And we're making mandu and jiaozi, it's Chinese dumplings. And so, yeah, we laid out wrappers and filling and a diverse community of people showed up, East Asians, but also, you know, Jewish members of the community, South Asians, Daisy community members. And we all sat down to make the dumplings. We did a lesson, but the conversations at the table had nothing to do with dumplings. It's about ICE. It's about local schools and how tough it is to pay the rent and figure out after school. It was exactly what, again, my mom and my aunties did when we were growing up. It's trying to figure out how to get by in this city, in this place, and also talking about like bigger things, bigger themes of politics, of war, of immigration, and just having your hands be busy making dumplings and having your stomach be busy digesting dumplings, I feel like opens the door to these much more important conversations.
You call yourself a progressive. I've had a love-hate relationship with the term itself. I do in some instances identify as a progressive, but I feel like I'm moving more towards being a leftist because in my mind, and I am not a political science graduate, but I will say this, the way I see progressivism, it's like enacting change within systems, doing reformation work mostly. But when we think of being a leftist, it really hinges on dismantling the systems. And when I look at what you're trying to achieve, you've talked about abolishing ICE, you've talked about Medicare for all, you don't take money from super PACs, you don't take money from APAC. That is dismantling the system in a way, right? How do you define your version of progressivism?
You know, I am brand new to politics. I know that there are these labels and these affiliations that always evolve. I mean, back in the day, maybe you're called a liberal and progressive, leftist, or radical. I can tell you how I define what I'm fighting for, and you can call me what you want. I want to abolish ICE. I want to dismantle an agency that is the opposite of safety and the opposite of law enforcement. They are terrorizing people, shooting us dead in the streets, grabbing us and leaving us to die on the side of the road. That's what ICE is. They need to be abolished. I also think we have to end the wars, and we need to stop funding a genocide. And then I think we need to end this explicit open corruption in our government, whether it's corporate PACs and super PACs powering elected officials' campaigns, both Democrats and Republicans, or it's lobbyists right in Queens in the neighborhoods I want to represent, giving money and handouts to local elected leaders to get permission to build a casino in the heart of working class immigrant communities. So I want to abolish ICE. I want to end the war, stop funding genocide, and I want to end this corporate corruption that is destroying our democracy. You know, there's some parts of the system that I want to protect.
Right.
Democracy.
What are some of the parts that you want to protect?
So, you know, first of all, democracy, it's under attack, but, I don't think we should have, you know, some kind of violent revolution.
Right.
You know, I think people should vote and they should express themselves through public protests and rallies, and then they should vote in leaders who they think are fighting for their values. So that should be protected. I don't want to change that. I also want to protect and expand what I call this promise, maybe the foundational promise of Queens, of New York City, of the entire country, and that is, it doesn't matter where in the world you come from, where in the country you come from. Once you're here, this place is supposed to give you a home and a future. As long as you work hard and you live honestly. And that promise is what my parents believed in. They came in the 80s from Korea. They worked as street peddlers. They worked really hard. And back then, their hard work enabled them to buy a home, to raise five kids. We all grew up. I grew up to become from the child of street peddlers to a U.S. diplomat representing this very rich, very powerful country. And so, that promise, I think, is a good part of the system. Call it economic mobility. And that promise is being destroyed. So I want to protect that promise and expand it for more people.
Chuck, there's so much to deconstruct in what you just said. But I do want to say one thing. When we talk about working hard, we hear this a lot around immigrants and their kids too, right? I am an immigrant, grew up in Pakistan. Although I see myself as a privileged immigrant, right? But at the end of the day, we are told that we should work hard. And that's almost like euphemism for you have to prove your worth in some ways, right? So when we say work hard, it's almost as if we are putting the burden on immigrants to prove their worthiness in this society. Do you think there's a way to rephrase it in a way where, yes, everybody should work hard, but the onus doesn't lie only with immigrants and their kids?
Yeah, that's totally fair. And it's not about a burden or, something to beat over the head of new immigrants that, hey, you better kill yourself. You better let us exploit you in unsafe working conditions and get paid sub-minimum wages as an undocumented person. That's how you earn opportunity in this country. So it's definitely not that at all. When I think about this idea that immigrants come and they want to work hard and live honestly, I think of going back generations to look, I'm Korean, you said you're from Pakistan, but think of the first Irish or Italian or Ashkenazi Jewish immigrants to New York City. They were living in tenements in places like the Lower East Side, running push carts, also street vending. And they also were exploited by the system. They were abused by police officers, kicked them off their street corners. They suffered through economic exploitation. And so work hard for me means if you come here and you're just trying to be a normal, like, functioning member of American society, like it doesn't mean like you have to subjugate yourself.
Yeah, yeah.
It also doesn't mean that you have to be a superhero. You just have to be a normal working person in New York City, and that should be enough to earn your place here.
Absolutely. Being human is what we all try and aspire to be, right? Because there's so much focus on what being an immigrant means in this country. And the other day I posted something on Instagram about the new citizenship test. And obviously there were a lot of trolls and they were like, you don't belong here. And I was like, first of all, the amount of taxes that my household alone pays and creates jobs. And I don't want to brag, but I felt like bragging. I was like, that's equivalent to probably 3 yearly incomes for somebody. So I do belong, even if you don't see the moral argument. Let's see the economic argument, and you can do the math and see how important immigrants are. But let's go back to something else you said, dismantling ICE. Now, a lot of people, when they hear dismantling ICE, it's like, oh my gosh, we'll have open borders, not realizing that ICE was formed in 2003 and borders were fine before that. What does it mean? Are you talking about the deportation arm of the ICE that you want to dismantle? Can you break it down?
Sure. And yeah, I want to hit that point. So first of all, ICE doesn't do borders, right? That's CBP.
Right.
There's a whole other sub-agency.
That's a different agency altogether.
And you're right. We had a country and borders before ICE existed, right? With the INS, before George W. Bush and 9/11 and the reaction to that. So we can have a country with borders without ICE. What I mean is, in the last year and a half under this president, ICE has added 12,000 new officers using that $75 billion new dollars that they've received. And so the majority of ICE are now these 12,000 new officers with almost no training. A lot of them have criminal backgrounds. They have a Glock and bulletproof vests and masks, and they are on our streets. And we see what they're doing. They murdered people in broad daylight. They're pepper spraying people at point blank range, students and high school students. They grabbed this Rohingya refugee upstate New York, left him to die on the side of the road in the cold. That's what ICE is doing now. That's ICE in 2026. So that is what has to be dismantled. I don't see a badge and some extra training fixing those 12,000 new officers who've been doing all that other terrible stuff. So abolishing ICE means defunding that agency. And then we could talk about reconstructing interior immigration enforcement. I do believe, for example, that if you are a violent criminal who has gone through full due process and been convicted of something, that maybe you do not have a place in our society. But that's not the vast, vast, vast majority of people who are in this country as immigrants, whether they're undocumented or semi-documented with DACA or TPS. The vast, vast, vast majority of immigrants in this country are just working, raising their families, paying taxes, just like the rest of us.
How do you parse out this dichotomy between good and bad immigrant? Because sometimes these conversations end up there, right? If you're a good immigrant, you can stay here. And then the definition of bad immigrant is pretty arbitrary. It depends on who's in the office, who is talking to crowds.
Bad immigrant is used as this political tool to attack enemies. And so you see it with, in particular, student activists at Columbia University. There was obviously Mahmoud Khalil, who had a green card. You know, he is a legal immigrant with, he's a national of the United States, technically. He was exercising his First Amendment rights, which is, again, it's the First Amendment of our Constitution. It is one of our most sacred rights. And that's what he was doing. And he was labeled a foreigner, a bad immigrant, you know, set up to be deported, missed the birth of his child for that. So while I believe that is a good immigrant, not just a good immigrant, that's a good American.
Right.
Exercising that right. Trump and his regime labeled him a bad immigrant, a foreigner. They even did the same thing to a Korean-American student, I think also had a green card at Columbia. And so it is absolutely a manipulative political tactic to label people bad immigrants. I think immigrants are people. You don't label good people bad people, good American citizens, bad American citizens. If you're here and you're not hurting anybody else, then you're fine. I think that's it.
Let's extend this conversation to something else that you have openly talked about, what's happening in Gaza. You call it a genocide. Now, I have human rights background. I've studied international law. I remember when things were unfolded in 2024, we did a whole episode on Immigrantly and we called it a genocide based on the definition of genocide. But a lot of times, the Jewish community, especially in New York and elsewhere, sees it as an attack on them, right? When we say what's happening in Gaza is a genocide. This is something that's been in the news for so long. And politicians have dealt with it differently. All politicians have. Democratic establishment has been a disappointment in this regard.
Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, one of the heaviest topics you can talk about. And let me say, first of all, if you can't call it a genocide at this point, not just after Jewish scholars of Holocaust history at the Hebrew University of Jerusalem are calling it a genocide, not just after the images and the official statistics of tens upon tens upon tens of thousands of innocent civilians killed, including many, many young children. If you can't be either moved or rationally convinced to call it genocide, I think you're on the wrong side of history. It is a genocide, and it's not about who has the right to use that word. There's a definition, and you can look it up, and there are experts who understand that definition and have said, yeah, this qualifies. In terms of how to communicate that and how certain communities, you mentioned the Jewish community in New York City and Queens and the whole country, perceive that word, I understand that the most historic and tragic genocide in the history of human beings on this planet was the Holocaust. Millions killed over a span of just a few years. And that is horrific. And so that word has a particular weight on that community. And so I think we have to return to the idea that there are fundamental human rights. This isn't about some kind of fight between religious groups or ethnic groups. No, this is about a group of people being systematically murdered on purpose by a regime, and a regime that the United States is sending money and weapons to every single year, all the time. And so I try to focus on that. This is a fundamental moral crisis and human rights crisis. It's not about this religion or that religion, this ethnic group versus that one. We should be calling this out wherever it's happening in the world. And it is happening in Gaza. And it is being perpetrated by the state of Israel, led by Prime Minister Netanyahu, who in my book is a war criminal, a terrible human being.
Absolutely. And you said something in one of your interviews that really resonated with me. And I also ascribe to the same kind of thinking. You said something about, look, we don't send money to other countries, or we don't have foreign lobbies like Chinese foreign lobby, or in my case, I would say Pakistani foreign lobby, influencing elections in the US. And if there was a Pakistani foreign lobby influencing US politicians, I would be against it, although I grew up in Pakistan. And if there were an American foreign lobby influencing elections in Pakistan, I would be against that as well. Chuck, why is it so difficult for people to grasp this simple idea of American politicians should serve the American people?
I don't know why people don't get it. And actually, you know what? I'll say the opposite. I think people are starting to get it. Like, no, I don't know why my local state assembly member or my local member of Congress or my local city council member is taking money and getting support, financial support, from an organization that is wholly interested in a foreign country.
Right.
I've heard certain arguments, and let me debunk them. I've heard, oh, don't you know that here's a list of dozens and dozens of other nations that conduct lobbying in the United States? That's true. Saudi Arabia, South Korea, I mean, and private corporations that are partially owned by those governments, sure, they lobby the U.S. government. They don't interfere in elections, right? They lobby, you know, senior officials who are at certain agencies. They don't jump into a local congressional race and then inject six figures, seven figures of dollars to elect somebody who they think is favorable to their country. That is the key difference. And AIPAC does it all the time. And there are obviously strings attached. You know, the person I'm running against, I think she's taken a history of her time in Congress, seven digits, you know, more than $1 million of donations from AIPAC and their bundlers. And hey, no surprise, she votes with Republicans to condemn the International Criminal Court and protect Benjamin Netanyahu. No surprise that every single year she reapproves unconditional military aid to the state of Israel. No surprise that she didn't call for a ceasefire. No surprise that she can't call a genocide a genocide.
I do want to pivot to something else.
Sure, it's a pretty heavy conversation.
Yeah. So I've seen your social media campaign, and I'm impressed. I was following Mayor Mamdani's social media campaign, and I believe social media has become such a powerful tool for grassroots movements like yours and Mayor Mamdani's and others. And you made this whole video about how you've been burned by the Working Families Party. Now, I am somebody who always votes on their, like, you know, ticket. I'm like, okay, if they've endorsed this person, I will vote for them. You talk about the politics of it. You know, when I was watching the video and I was thinking about it later, and I'm like, you know, that's what worries me about the system itself. Because when you think of Working Families Party, you would think of, oh my gosh, progressive, leftist, whatever you call them, right? Grassroots, obviously prioritizing the American people first. And yet there are things happening within at the leadership level where you were endorsed by their Queen's chapter, 90%. You were endorsed by their regional, and yet they did not endorse you. Are you bitter?
I'm still stunned. I think that's the one word I'd use to describe myself. I'm not a politician. I had a city agency job. My wife's a nurse. We were just paying the rent and getting more and more pissed off about the state of our city and country up until I decided to run for office in November. So I don't fully understand, like, these political machinations and this process behind the scenes in private meetings. So like you, I thought, oh, Working Families Party. They are fighting for working families. It's in the name. And they do have a process to apply. And I just very, maybe naively, just followed their process. You know, you do an interview with the local chapter. Turns out they love me. They voted to approve me 90%. Great. Sounds like my message works. Looks like they want me as their champion. Then I met this regional body, and that includes a lot of institutional nonprofits. They love me too. Had a 2/3 vote. I thought I was doing great. I was like, oh yeah, makes perfect sense. I come from a working family. I'm fighting for those same values. Turns out, no, there was this secret final boss, which are a few people in a closed door room who are taking calls with established Democratic leadership, the people that I think the Working Families Party claims to be fighting against or to be pushing to the more progressive end. But no, they were talking in a quiet, closed door meeting, and they decided to kill my endorsement. So it was a bitter lesson. I'm still shocked. I'm still shocked that that actually happens, that there are these closed door meetings where even a progressive, openly progressive organization can be moved by institutional forces that are against progress. So I made a video because I just had to just download what I learned in this process as a normal person going through it and just share it with anybody watching. Like, I wanted people to understand that these kind of like establishment politics also are pervading even progressive movements.
But I would not have thought of the Working Families Party as establishment. So what gives you hope then? Because the system is fucked up.
Totally.
Right? And you resigned as a US diplomat, and then you decide to join politics. What gives you hope then?
So what gives me hope, and you got to this a little bit with social media, you're talking about Mayor Mamdani, is all of these gatekeepers, these organizations that give out endorsements or established press, these people who prevent you from connecting directly with people, those gatekeepers are getting less and less and less relevant. Because now I can record something honest and authentic, put it on an Instagram reel, and then blast it out to tens of thousands of people right now. And so I don't need to be dismissed, decoded, and I'm reaching directly to normal people in Queens and in New York City. And that's what inspires me, that they see the message and they see themselves reflected in the message, and that the parasocial relationship where they're watching a reel or they're watching some content that I put out turns into a social relationship. They show up for a canvassing shift to knock on doors. So just this past weekend, we had a weekend of action, and we had more than 50 people show up. And a lot of them said, yeah, I saw a reel. You ask people to help you knock on doors in Jackson Heights or in Forest Hills. That's why I'm here. And so I get to meet someone who is before that just a view or a like. I get to meet them in the real world. And not only meet them, they are also inspired to take action. They're not just passively hitting a heart button. They are spreading the same message of change, of fighting back against this oligarchy, of fighting back against these bought politicians. They're taking that same message door to door. And so it's scaling, it's growing. And so that is the most inspirational thing for me to see.
Who are your supporters?
My supporters are, I got a lot of working moms. It's a lot of working moms, and it's sad to say, but it's still true. Working moms are the backbone of families in the United States of America, and absolutely the backbone of families in Queens. My wife's a working mom. It's Mother's Day this Sunday. But they're the ones who are organized. They're keeping the family schedule and calendar up. They're making sure that kids are keeping up with assignments. So they are natural organizers, and they have the natural self-interest in change. They're the ones who have to figure out childcare and then stitch together the after-school program, the summer program for somewhere safe for their kids. And unfortunately, they're still the ones who have to help pay the bills, keep track of everything, take kids to doctor's appointments so they need healthcare. They get the bills in the mail. They have to sit on hold with an insurance company to be denied their claim. So working moms are a big portion of this coalition that is showing up for me. Another big portion is younger people. You know, call them Gen Z or even younger than that, Gen Alpha. And for them, as I speak to them, my understanding is they're so sick and tired of, like, I call it the bland instant mashed potatoes of politics that they grew up with. You know, people like, I'm sorry, Kamala Harris.
Oh my gosh.
Joe Biden.
I have so many thoughts.
Yeah, we could talk about that, but I call it the bland instant mashed potatoes where, when I think about Queens, there's so much spice, there's so much flavor and fire, and they're looking for leaders who will reflect that, who can be passionate and who can be absolutely clear about their moral convictions, even if they don't agree about policies. They just want some honesty. And they're sick of focus group tested talking points and high production quality videos. The good news is I don't have the money for any of that and I don't have a focus group or anything. So I think they're excited to meet someone who's a real human being telling them how I really feel.
You've stayed away from DSA, right? You've talked about how you don't see yourself fit in there. How so?
I wouldn't say that. Many of my staff members are DSA members, active, and my volunteers are DSA members. Mm. So I think there's probably total alignment in the policies and the vision I have for Queens, this city, and this country with DSA. That said, I did not pursue the DSA endorsement that's what you're referring to. The reason is, I'm pretty simple. Again, coming from outside of politics, after I announced, I saw this rough episode. It's pretty local to New York, but there was a city council member, Chiyose. He wanted to run against Hakeem Jeffries, the establishment of the establishment, right? And one of the first things he did was seek the DSA endorsement, coming from not a long history of organizing and building the DSA, but as someone who's perceived as a last minute opportunist trying to get on board with this big, powerful machine that just won a mayoral election. And he went to this vote for the DSA. I think he was received poorly. The mayor, I think, did not back him, publicly said, no, sorry, DSA, don't support this guy. He didn't get the endorsement. And he dropped out of the race immediately. So I saw that happen. I was like, I don't want that.
Was disappointed in the mayor as well, because he hasn't been as vocal against Hakeem Jeffries either. And I don't know why. When I see this with AOC, it makes me think how honest people can be once they become beneficiaries of the system.
Yeah, ask me again after I win. I'll come right back and I'll tell you. I get it. He's the mayor now. He's done campaigning. He has to make sure that he can pass a city budget. He has to provide services and he has to work with federal officials, especially, powerful federal officials, to make sure that he gets the resources that the city needs. But yes, there's also such a thing as having conviction and the courage of your conviction. And I'm sure on many policies, there's a lot of disagreement between Mayor Mamdani and Hakeem Jeffries. That's a great question from Mayor Mamdani. I'm sure he's trying to weigh those things, both to deliver for the people in New York City, but also make sure he doesn't sacrifice his own values in the process.
I am a big fan. I always quote this. I interviewed him in 2020 when he was just an assembly member.
That's a great precedent. I love it. I'm here as a candidate and who knows where I'll be in a few years.
That's what I was going to say. I think Immigrant Lee is lucky for a lot of people. If this doesn't work, if Queens votes for the safe choice again, what does that mean to you? What's next for you?
So I'm going to win it. I think people are fed up with the status quo.
Yeah, let's manifest that.
People are fed up with the status quo. They're frustrated with leaders who don't have the fight in them, won't fight back, and won't fight to build a better promise for all of us. So I'm going to win it in June, and then I'll win it in November, and we'll keep winning it.
I love it.
But alternate universe, if I lose this in the primary election, I go back to being a dad and a local organizer. The first thing I'll do is I'll finally do a deep clean of the house. I'll do all the laundry that's not getting done. I'll clean the bathroom and the kitchen, take my wife out to a long overdue date night, and then take my kids to the beach and just spend a lot of time with them that I have not been able to do while I'm running this campaign. After that, I think we keep up the fight, keep up the pressure, because, it's not about one election. It's not about one dude in Queens trying to win one seat. It's about this movement. And so whether or not I win this primary, and I will win, but there is a bigger movement that needs to be sustained, that is already growing and has to keep growing, because I can't afford to lose. I mean that literally, not,
absolutely.
I'm on my wife's health care. She could be laid off from her private hospital and I will have no health care. And I definitely can't afford the premiums on the ACA. I have two kids. I need that child care. I can't afford to be living in, thanks 3K and 4K in New York City, but I can't afford child care. And so I selfishly need to win those things, whether I do it in office or I do it as an organizer outside. I need universal healthcare. I need childcare. I need us to stop wasting all of our tax dollars blowing up families in Caracas or Gaza or Iran. We need that right here at home. And so that will continue whatever the results of this June primary.
We'll manifest it.
Yeah, absolutely.
You will win, inshallah.
I will win.
What is your expectation from 2028 presidential elections? Because as a Democratic voter, I don't feel like voting for anybody right now. I keep thinking, give me a better option. I am not ready to vote for these people. Do you see potential in anyone, anywhere?
I think it's super early. It's 2026. It is right now, 2028 is only 2 years away. But I think someone will emerge. I think that person, whoever emerges, has to be authentic, has to speak honestly, has to have the courage of their convictions. That already rules out most of the field. And so I hope someone emerges who can speak plainly and honestly to the American people, and someone who is unapologetically going to fight for working people in this country, and won't gaslight the American public saying, hey, we're fine, we just need a tiny bit of progress, fix things on the edges. No, we need health care, we need Medicare for all. Our families can't afford to wait any longer. We need to end these wars and stop killing people. Our souls can't bear that anymore. So someone who can say that plainly and honestly, I hope that is who emerges. I think that's what the American people want. Someone in the style of, I think AOC actually does it great. I think she does balance this conviction while also understanding that there is a political process and there are relationships. And so I hope she emerges as that leader. I'm not sure what will happen. There's this movement and it's building, and so we'll see.
In the end, Chuck, if you were to define the United States of America in a word or a sentence, how will you do that?
I just call it the promise.
I love it. This was so good. And we want you to win. So tell us, where can people go and vote, when, and where can they donate?
Sure. So the election is June 23rd. So people in Queens, in the 6th District, June 23rd is the election. Vote for Chuck Park. If you want to support me, there's two ways. One is sign up for a shift. If you're close enough to my communities, then sign up for a shift at chuckforqueens.com/join. And if you're far away, but you've heard something that's moved you, that makes you want to plug into this movement, but you can't sign up for a door knocking shift, go to chuckforqueens.com/donate. And that's how we're going to win it.
Wonderful. Best of luck. We are manifesting it for you.
Manifesting.
It was such a pleasure to sit down with Chuck Park, talk about his politics, his aspirations for future. And you know what? If you are in NY6, do consider voting for him on June 23rd. You know what I liked about this conversation is how honest he is, how we could go back and forth on some points that we may disagree on, and how attentive he is when I was talking. And that's a rare combination, especially in politicians. And let me tell you, he does not come across as a typical politician, because he's not. You will hear from more people in the political ecosystem, especially in summer on Immigrant League. These conversations will be political, but in a good way. I hope you enjoy these conversations as much as you enjoy our other conversations. This episode was written and produced by me, Sadia Khan. The editorial review is done by Shea Yu. Our sound designer and editor is Lou Raskin. Immigrantly's theme music is by Simon Hutchinson, other music by Epidemic Sound. Come back next week for another Immigrantly conversation. Until then, take care.